There are people who let their work speak for them. And then there are people who shout so loudly about how brilliant they are, you start to wonder what they're trying to drown out.
You've never met anyone with as much willpower as me. And whatever it is you think you're good at in your life, I'd probably take about a year and become an authority in the field in which you think you're good.
I'm both on a raw IQ scale smarter than almost every coach, maybe every coach. And I know more about physiology, body responses, etc., than they do.
You are presuming you know more than me about the thing I'm one of the top experts in the world in, and also the thing I'm literally involved in myself. So whatever ideas you have about how I can improve, just f*** right off.
There's a very high probability that I'm much better at making fun of people than you are.
So naturally, when I got my hands on Mike Israetel's PhD thesis, I expected a masterwork, an intellectual tour de force. Instead,
I am a perfectionist asshole with a PhD. Yeah, hell yeah, that's why I say shit like that.
Dr. Mike, geez, that's a big deal. And I've noticed that carries a lot of weight. Like all I feel is rage and frustration.
What I got was a document so sloppy, shallow, and confused, it could only pass in a system that had already failed.
Other JD students at Melbourne Law School use their database access to read case law. I used mine to download Mike Israetel's PhD thesis, which I read in its entirety. For those unfamiliar, Mike Israetel is a prominent figure in the fitness world. He's a competitive bodybuilder, a highly successful YouTuber, and the creator of the popular Exercise Scientist Critique series. Mike frequently highlights his status as a PhD holder across all his platforms, from his Instagram handle to dozens of YouTube videos.
Dr. Mike here for RP Strength.
His company website and advertised products. But what about the academic rigor of the PhD itself? In this video, we'll examine just that. I'll conduct a critical analysis of the doctoral research that forms the basis of Mike's credibility as an exercise scientist. In chapter 2 of this video, I'll provide an overview of Mike's thesis. Chapter 3 will then outline the standard assessment criteria for PhD theses. Building on this, Chapter 4 presents my core argument, that by these standard academic criteria, Mike's PhD thesis would likely fail, or at the very least be sent back for major revisions at any high-ranking university. Chapter 5 outlines why this finding matters, and I conclude in Chapter 6 by tying the threads together. I'll show how Mike's PhD thesis, far from bolstering his credibility, actually destroys it.
Mike Israetel's PhD thesis, titled The Interrelationships of Fitness Characteristics in Division I Athletes, investigates how various fitness traits, including strength, rate of force development, power, vertical jump height, short distance sprinting speed, and body composition relate to one another in Division I collegiate athletes. The overarching aim is to explore the extent to which athletic performance can be understood as the summation of these interrelated physical attributes. 80 NCAA Division I athletes from four sports, baseball, women's volleyball, men's soccer, and women's soccer, participated in a longitudinal athlete monitoring program at East Tennessee State University. They underwent assessments of maximal strength, rate of force development, power output, vertical jump height, short distance sprinting speed, and body composition. Statistical analyses examined correlations among these measures, as well as differences between high and low performing subgroups. The results demonstrated that 1. Strength strongly correlates with muscularity. 2. Athletes with higher relative force and power output demonstrate superior jumping and sprinting ability. And 3. Leaner athletes outperform less lean athletes in nearly all metrics, especially relative strength, power, vertical jumping, and sprinting. Perhaps unsurprisingly, these results largely aligned with conventional sports science assumptions, that leaner, stronger, and more muscular athletes tend to perform better in key physical domains. In his conclusion, Mike summarizes his findings, which basically just reinforce existing wisdom about athletic performance. Mike suggests how future research could explore how fitness priorities might vary across skill levels, but offers little in the way of specific methodological approaches or clearly defined unanswered questions. In short, Mike's thesis consolidates the widely held view in sports science that it's a good idea for aspiring athletes to become leaner, stronger, and more muscular. Before we critically examine Mike's thesis, we need objective criteria to assess it by. Although the core expectations and assessment criteria for a PhD thesis are remarkably consistent globally, my alma mater, Melbourne University, can serve as a guide. To be awarded a pass, a doctoral thesis must A. demonstrate authority in the candidate's field and show evidence of command of knowledge in relevant fields. So you have to inspire trust in the reader. The reader should get the impression that you're a reliable investigator in the field. You're an equal among peers who have also advanced it. B. Demonstrate a thorough grasp of the methodological techniques appropriate to the research question and an awareness of their limitations. So it's not enough just to choose a methodology. You have to persuade the reader that you chose it for a good reason. C. Make a contribution to knowledge that rests on originality of approach and/or interpretation of the findings, and in some cases, the discovery of new facts. So you have to offer a genuinely new contribution that meaningfully advances your field. You can't just replicate or tweak past work. D. Demonstrate the candidate's ability to communicate research findings effectively. So you can't bury your findings in jargon or submit something that reads like an unedited draft. Your thesis has to be clearly written, professionally presented, and free from basic mistakes, whether in language, formatting, or data handling. E. Demonstrate an understanding of and commitment to research ethics and integrity. So all that really just means is that you have to conduct your research responsibly. And that means, you know, just being transparent, getting explicit consent from any participant, etc. And F, be a careful, rigorous, and sustained piece of work, demonstrating that a research apprenticeship is complete and the holder may be admitted to the community of scholars in the discipline. So you can't just stitch together a few chapters and call it a thesis. The whole thing needs to be coherent, meticulously edited, internally consistent, and attentive to detail, which includes, of course, how your data are presented, interpreted, and integrated across chapters. In this chapter, I'll argue that, according to standard assessment criteria, Mike's thesis would have failed, or at the very least been sent back for major revisions at any high-ranking university. Mike's thesis falls short of fulfilling one of the most fundamental requirements for doctoral research, a significant contribution of original knowledge. The stated goal of Mike's thesis was to explore interrelationships among fitness variables that he claimed were less clear in the existing literature. However, the core findings, that stronger athletes are more muscular and powerful, that more powerful athletes jump higher and sprint faster, and that leaner athletes perform better in these tasks, are not only unsurprising, but also extensively documented in prior research, even by 2013. You don't have to take it from me. Just listen to Mike himself, who openly concedes this throughout the document. For instance, in Chapter 3, Mike explicitly notes that the finding that stronger athletes produce higher rates of force development has been previously well supported in the literature, and that the finding of higher power-generating abilities being associated with stronger athletes is well supported by previous data. On the following page, he acknowledges that stronger athletes, especially relative to their body mass, tend to jump higher and sprint faster, and that his findings merely show trends in this direction. He repeats this theme in Chapter 4, when he affirms that his results concord with much of the other research on the relationships between power, body composition, and athletic performance. By Chapter 5, the pattern is unmistakable. The abstract reiterates that athletes with higher lean body mass and lower body fat are stronger, more powerful, and faster, reinforcing the importance of body composition, a point that has been reinforced in many previous publications. Pages 97 through 98 continue this line, noting that the observed correlations concord well with existing literature. In the final summary, Mike concludes that relative strength is a better predictor of performance than absolute strength, based both on the findings of previous literature and this investigation. Nearly every major result is explicitly framed as a confirmation of prior research, rather than a departure from it. To be clear, replication is a valuable part of scientific practice. Confirmatory studies can reinforce confidence in previous findings, especially when using diverse populations or refined measurement tools. But a PhD thesis isn't just a scientific study. It's a scholarly work held to a higher standard. It's supposed to demonstrate that the candidate can contribute new knowledge to his or her field, not just affirm what's already well accepted. By that criterion, Mike's dissertation doesn't qualify. Mike's thesis proposes no new theories, investigates no novel mechanisms nor methods, and makes no methodological innovations. It's a largely descriptive work that fails to advance the conceptual boundaries of sports science in any meaningful way. Another way Mike's thesis could be said to lack originality is its dearth of independence in thought and approach. While it is expected that a PhD candidate will ground his or her work in existing literature, Mike's thesis rarely moves beyond mere reiteration. As I'll detail later, the literature review in Mike's thesis is uncritical. It's just an inventory of past findings rather than an evaluative synthesis. And that kind of passive engagement with sources continues throughout the thesis. Mike's research questions are framed in terms of small, population-specific gaps, without articulating why these gaps matter or whether existing models should be expected to fail in the context of Division I athletes. Merely noting the absence of data isn't on its own a meaningful justification for research. A legitimate research gap demands a theoretical reason to believe that something unexpected, different, or revelatory might be found. Who knows, perhaps even something counter-expected, to borrow from Mike's idiolect. This is something Mike's thesis never provides. Mike's lack of independence in thought and approach is evident in the methodology as well. All performance tests, analytical techniques, and interpretative frameworks appear to be taken directly from existing literature, most often from Mike's supervisor, Mike Stone, and close colleagues, without exploration of alternatives or acknowledgement of limitations. The thesis doesn't test new models, question prevailing assumptions, nor integrate competing viewpoints. The lack of originality in the thesis is therefore not surprising. It's the predictable result of a research process that never stepped outside its own circle to ask new questions. A doctoral thesis isn't evaluated just on the originality or significance of its content, but also the clarity and accuracy with which that content is presented. Mike Israetel's thesis fails comprehensively on this front. Across the thesis, Mike presents impossible and contradictory data, inflates simple points with jargon, and allows hundreds of basic grammatical, typographical, and formatting errors to remain uncorrected. The following sections unpack these issues in detail, and by the end, you'll see that it's impossible to view Mike's work as anything but fundamentally compromised. Some of the data Mike presents in the extreme group comparison tables are statistically impossible. On page 77, Mike acknowledges the large standard deviations in tables 4.6 and 4.7. But how large are we talking? Well, let's examine. I'll put on screen tables 4.6 and 4.7, which are on page 71. They compare the top 20 and bottom 20 jumpers. Tables 4.6 and 4.7 report that for the 20 lowest performers, the mean body masses were 73.9 kilos and 75.3 kilos respectively, with standard deviations of 71.8 kilos, virtually equal to the means themselves. This is a statistical absurdity. Standard deviation measures the spread of the data around the mean. A standard deviation this large, relative to the mean, is nonsensical in a biological context. For this to be true, given a normal distribution, it would mean that roughly one-third of the lowest performing athletes in Table 4.6 had a body mass either greater than 145.7 kilos or less than 2.1 kilos, the weight of a newborn. And since we know that this group consists of 20 Division I college athletes, this is impossible. But it gets even worse. In Table 4.6, one-third of the lowest performers was either older than age 41.2 or younger than negative 1.6. So they hadn't even been born. In Table 4.7, one-third was either older than age 41.1 or younger than negative 1.3. Mike does this again on page 94 in Table 5.4. As with Tables 4.6 and 4.7, the standard deviations for the lowest performers are impossible. Here, one-third of the lowest performers was either taller than 3.459 meters, taller than any human ever recorded, or shorter than negative 6.1 centimeters. As to age, either they were older than 40.4 years of age, or younger than negative 1.4 years, meaning, once again, that they hadn't yet been born. No wonder they were such low performers. These are numbers so fundamentally wrong that they could only result from incompetent data entry, which is exactly what's happened here. Mike appears to have simply copied the mean figures of the highest performers and pasted them as the standard deviations of the lowest performers. To have made this mistake just once would be damning enough. But Mike makes this exact same error in three separate tables. These mistakes invalidate the entire tables and any conclusions drawn from them. If this doesn't count as ineffective communication of research findings, then nothing does. Further incompetence can be seen in Mike's handling of percent differences. Take Table 5.5, where the majority of percent differences reported is negative. However, Mike omits the minus sign altogether in Figures 5.1 and 5.2, as well as in the text on page 96. For example, he writes of an 8% difference without clarifying that the value in question was actually negative 8.71% according to Table 5.5. And Mike's rounding is also both imprecise and inconsistent. Starting with imprecision, percent differences of negative 8.71% and negative 7.91% are both inexplicably rounded up to 8%. As to inconsistency, a smaller difference of 2.42% is rounded more precisely to 2.4%, whereas all of the other percent differences are rounded to whole numbers. Mike gives no explanation for these discrepancies, and this sloppiness with the handling of percent differences crops up not just in Chapter 5, but also Chapters 3 and 4. This leads one to have rather little confidence in the care that was taken to present the results faithfully. I also want to highlight a finding in Table 4.4 that flatly contradicts one of the central premises of Mike's thesis, which is that jump height correlates with sprint speed. This holds for the female athlete. Table 4.4 shows a strong negative correlation, negative 0.617, between jump height and 20-meter sprint time, as expected. But for the male athletes, the reported correlation is positive, 0.653, suggesting, bizarrely, that higher jumpers were actually slower sprinters. Now, Mike never acknowledges nor explains this contradiction. Most likely it's just a typo, a missing minus sign. On its own, it wouldn't be damning. But given the context of the other glaring data errors, as well as many other basic mistakes that I'll detail later, it becomes part of a much larger pattern of negligence. When your tables repeatedly include sprinters who haven't been born yet, athletes shorter than 0 centimeters, and standard deviations that imply body masses smaller than a house cat, or larger than an offensive lineman riding another offensive lineman, it's no longer just sloppy. It's disqualifying. Throughout Mike's thesis, simple ideas are inflated with verbose, pseudo-technical language. This habit appears as early as the first page of the introductory chapter. Let's look at this equation. Skill 1 plus skill 2 plus skill 3 plus ellipsis plus skill n equals athletic performance magnitude. Mike asserts that skills sum to generate athletic performance. But why do they sum and not multiply or interact in complex ways? Mike doesn't say.
My ideal day, I would go down into my basement office and do deep work, equations, systematizing things.
This equation is presented twice in the thesis without any justification. And worse, this is just a convoluted way of saying what Mike later admits on page 103. Sport performance depends on the athlete's ability to execute a combination of skills. Why not just state that from the outset, in clear language? The same can also be said of the other equation, fitness characteristics component plus technique components plus psychological component equals total skill magnitude, though there are bigger problems with this equation that I'll get into later. For now, let me draw your attention to how on page 33, Mike labels fitness characteristics, technique, and psychology as theoretical variables. Mike attempts to justify this by stating, these variables are theoretical because pure measurement of almost all of them is impossible, short of a few fitness characteristics, such as body mass and percent fat. But this is irrelevant to Mike's thesis. Had Mike just removed the word theoretical, which adds nothing anyway, he would have spared the reader this pointless philosophical digression. Mike's tendency to overcomplicate sometimes backfires. Consider page 14, where Mike defines fitness characteristics as theoretical constructs that obviate the input of any sport-specific technique or psychological variables. Not only is this phrasing clumsy, obviate the input is nonsensical in this context. To obviate means to make unnecessary, or to avoid, or prevent. But Mike misuses it here to mean something like exclude consideration of. What he's trying to say is simple. Fitness characteristics are physical traits, like strength and speed, independent of technique or mindset. But instead of stating that clearly, Mike buries it in pretentious sludge. This tendency to dress up the mundane reaches absurdity in Chapter 3, where Mike argues that allometrically scaled peak force is a superior predictor of performance to relative strength. But in his own tables, on pages 43, 66, and 91, he reports allometrically scaled peak force in newtons per kilogram, which is, by definition, a measure of relative strength. It's just the force an athlete produces divided by his or her body mass. True allometric scaling requires adjusting for nonlinear size relationships using an exponent, for example, mass to the power of 0.5, which Mike never does. So Mike has taken a basic calculation, relative strength, mislabeled it with a more complex and scientific-sounding term, allometric scaling, and then claimed its superiority over the very thing it actually is. It's as if he poured water into a fancy bottle, called it hydroosmotic elixir, and then claimed it's better than regular water. But in trying to sound more sophisticated, Mike inadvertently reveals a lack of understanding, both of the concepts involved and how to convey them clearly.
Say only what needs to be said, because wordiness can impede the ready grasp of ideas. So advises page 67 of the APA 6 publication manual, a resource Mike clearly should have followed much more closely, as the next section will make all too evident.
I don't like to nitpick the odd typo or formatting inconsistency. I acknowledge that minor errors are hard to avoid in any long document. But Mike Israetel's thesis doesn't just have a few scattered mistakes. It contains literally hundreds of basic grammatical, typographical, and formatting errors. I won't cover all of them here, since it would simply take too long. We can save it for a later video. But even a brief overview is enough to show that this isn't a matter of being overly critical. No reasonable standard of academic quality could justify a thesis this riddled with elementary errors. It speaks to a total lack of editorial care at every level, from the writer, Mike Israetel, to the supervisor, Mike Stone, to the examiners. One of the sloppiest features of Mike's thesis is the rampant copy-pasting of entire sections across chapters, with identical errors left untouched. The methods section, in chapters 4 and 5, are near-verbatim clones of those in chapter 3, reproducing the exact same typos, the exact same formatting mistakes, and the exact same structural oversights, of which there are many. Which is strong evidence that large portions of the thesis were duplicated wholesale without even a cursory proofread. For instance, all three chapters contain the same numbering error. Two consecutive items in a numbered list are labeled 4, an error that appears on pages 40, 62, and 87. Typos like mid-thing pull instead of mid-thigh pull show up first on page 44 and reappear on page 68. The phrase test rest reliability rather than test retest appears on three different pages. Clunky, ungrammatical phrasing, such as shown determinative instead of shown to be determinative, is copied across pages 42 and 65. Even complex citation strings with missing punctuation, inconsistent spacing, and misformatted elements recur word for word in multiple locations. On pages 61 and 86, Mike writes, a large group of athletes was tested in strength, RFD, strength, power, short distance sprinting, and body composition measurements. The word strength is included twice in the same list. This reads more like kinoparity than kinesiology.
Ever since I was 6 years old, I wanted to crack the code to building a body that was powerful, strong, and powerful.
That such obvious mistakes made it into the final version not just once, but twice or even thrice, suggests that no one, not the author, not his supervisor, and not the examiners, was paying much attention. Mike doesn't just copy-paste across chapters. He even does it within them. On page 74, the exact same passage appears twice in a row, verbatim. This pattern of duplication and error isn't just a sign of laziness. It raises serious doubts about whether much of the thesis was meaningfully reviewed at all. Mike's thesis, written in 2013, was required to comply with the APA 6th edition, the mandated style guide of East Tennessee State University's Sports Science and Coach Education Department. The thesis repeatedly fails to follow even the most basic rules of APA 6 citation and formatting. In-text citations are riddled with errors. Author groups are separated by commas instead of semicolons. Ampersands are replaced with and. Commas and periods are frequently misplaced or omitted. Punctuation appears before citations instead of after them. And bizarre constructions appear with inexplicable doubling up of brackets and periods. The problems don't end with citations in the body text. The reference lists themselves are an untamed mess. Across four separate bibliographies, Mike fails to italicize journal names, misformats volume and issue numbers, botches page ranges, uses commas where colons should be, and vice versa, inconsistently applies punctuation after journal titles, and freely oscillates between different spacing conventions. One reference alone, Cormier et al., 2010c, manages to misspell science as sense, list a physically impossible page range, implying that the article ends before it begins, it omits necessary spacing after punctuation, and it inserts a comma before the final period for good measure. This exact citation appears uncorrected on pages 52, 78, and 109. Such duplications not only reinforce the impression of thoughtless copy-pasting, but point to a total collapse of any editorial review process. Basic spelling errors are everywhere. Mike misspells the word vertical as vetical or vetrical, individual as invididual, properties as propertites, biomechanics as biomechanins, neural as neural, training as traininge, science as sense, as already noted, and exercise as exercise or exercise. Even worse are the misspelled names of cited researchers. Argard repeatedly becomes either Argard with a missing A or Argard. Clayson's turns into Clayson's Eat, and Haldeman is rendered without its final N. The journal title, European Journal of Applied Physiology, is mangled more than once, notably as European Journal Applied of Physiology. Perhaps the most common mechanical failure in the thesis is Mike's inability or refusal to press the spacebar. Missing spaces between words and after punctuation are so frequent, it's as if the spacebar was rationed. They're everywhere, and by the time you encounter the 100th instance, you're no longer wondering how they slipped through. You're wondering if Mike's keyboard was partially submerged in cement. On page 96, Mike claims to summarize the results of an investigation as illustrated in table 3.4. However, a quick glance at table 3.4, located on page 46, reveals a complete disconnect between the text and the table it purports to describe. The text on page 96 discusses a comparison of athletes based on their lean body mass, 2% fat ratio, but table 3.4 presents anthropometric data for athletes grouped by their performance in the allometrically scaled isometric mid-thigh pull. Mike likely meant table 5.5, not table 3.4. Grammatical errors are everywhere. One of the most persistent problems is subject-verb agreement. The plural noun, data, is repeatedly paired with singular verbs. Data was extracted. Data was assessed. The data was statistically analyzed, though he does occasionally get it right elsewhere. Sentence construction is similarly broken. Consider, break the path to a further elucidation, a muddled idiom that actually reverses its intended meaning. This purpose of this review is to blah blah blah. Allows of the examination of. On page 77, we get the phrase, does not shed skepticism. Mike probably meant cast doubt. On page 97, he writes of no counter-expected directions of association. Usually one just says unexpected. Punctuation is similarly chaotic. Semicolons are used where colons are required, redundant ellipses appear after etc., and periods appear in the wrong places. Hyphenation is inconsistent and often incorrect. Terms like outperform with a hyphen, well-trained with no hyphen, and p-value with no hyphen violate both standard and APA-specific conventions. In the appendices, Mike Stone is identified as the principal investigator, spelled P-L-E, from pages 125 to 133, before suddenly becoming the correctly spelled principal investigator, P-A-L, from pages 137 onward. And on the very last page, Mike's own CV. The formatting of his listed publications contains APA errors. In the acknowledgements, Mike Stone is thanked for the best scientific mentor he's ever had. Mike likely meant for being the best scientific mentor he's ever had. On the next line, Mike writes Mizuguchi for as one word. Mike then thanks his friends for tolerating his attitude on his so-called low-carb dissertation writing days. Judging by both the content of the dissertation as well as his physique at the time it was written, one might reasonably infer that such days were few and far between. The cumulative effect of all of these mistakes, copy-pasted sections, corrupted data, inconsistent citations, mangled references, typos, grammatical errors, and formatting violations, this really goes beyond acceptable oversight. While Mike's dissertation draws a plausible conclusion that leaner, stronger, and more muscular athletes tend to perform better, it falls short in yet another critical scholarly domain. It doesn't demonstrate that the methods used are appropriate, nor does it exhibit a clear understanding of their principles, strengths, and limitations. Nowhere is this clearer than in the treatment of the extreme group comparisons, which are used repeatedly throughout chapters 3, 4, and 5. In each case, Mike selects the top and bottom 5 performers from each of 4 sports, and discards the middle 50% of the sample. This is a bold analytical decision, particularly in a dataset of only 80 athletes. Yet the only explanation offered is that this was done, and I quote, to allow elucidation of relationships between fitness characteristics that illustrated meaningful differences by obviating the majority of athletes that performed close to the mean. An additional reason for such selection was to counterbalance each group against sport and sex type, as the groups have equal numbers of athletes from each sport as well as equal numbers of athletes of the same sex. This explanation is repeated across the thesis 3 times with the exact same wording and without elaboration. What's missing is a discussion of why removing the middle 50% is the best approach to identify meaningful relationships. Couldn't those average performers have contributed valuable information to a more nuanced analysis? What are the trade-offs involved in narrowing the sample in this way? Why not use regression models that preserve the full dataset and allow for statistical control of sex and sport instead of manually balancing the groups? These are questions that naturally arise and ought to be anticipated in a rigorous defense of the method. Instead, they go unaddressed. The absence of methodological reflection in the thesis extends beyond sampling decisions. Bonferroni adjustments, a statistical method used to reduce the risk of false positives when multiple comparisons are made, appear to be applied inconsistently and reported unevenly. While Chapter 5 includes a clear, albeit brief explanation of when and why the adjustment is used, earlier chapters lack this clarity. Across the thesis, there's no consistent rationale for when these adjustments are applied, nor any broader reflection on how these statistical choices affect the validity and interpretation of the findings. Similarly, Mike's thesis reports effect sizes alongside p-values, but often gives substantial rhetorical weight to non-significant findings with moderate or small non-trivial effect sizes, without clarifying how such differences should be interpreted in the broader evidentiary hierarchy of the study. None of this is to suggest that the thesis's analytical choices are necessarily unsound. Rather, the main issue is that Mike's thesis lacks a dedicated discussion, a page or two, at least, where such choices are confronted and defended openly. A section titled, say, "On the Appropriateness of the Methods Used," could have addressed why specific analytical strategies were chosen, what their limitations were, and how the findings should be interpreted in the light of those limitations. Without this, the dissertation comes across as methodologically opaque. The consequence is a thesis whose conclusions, however plausible, rest on foundations that haven't been clearly shown to be secure. This alone is sufficient grounds for the thesis to be sent back for revision. A doctoral thesis has to demonstrate deep, critical engagement with a complex body of knowledge. Mike's thesis doesn't. His literature review is superficial, his use of sources is marred by consistent misrepresentation, and his central claims rest on an artificial research gap. Mike's literature review in Chapter 2 is superficial. Chapter 2 reads as a descriptive summary of findings from various studies, rather than a critical synthesis. For example, when discussing anthropometry, he simply lists which body types succeed in various sports, without examining the methodologies of the cited studies, addressing conflicting findings, nor offering a nuanced interpretation. And this pattern persists across all topics, be it body composition, strength and power, or vertical jump height, where the discussion never goes beyond, "Well, this study found such and such," with no deeper analysis. At the end of his literature review, Mike notes that few studies have examined multiple variables' impact on sport performance. This line hints at the start of a substantive analysis, but it never materializes. Mike neither identifies such studies nor critiques their limitations, nor does he explain how his own thesis will address them. The assertion is left undeveloped, which is disappointing, because without any supporting evidence, the reader is left with no confidence in Mike's claims about the existence of a research gap. Overall, Mike's literature review functions as a perfunctory survey rather than a springboard for his research. Where Mike does attempt to identify a research gap, his argument is unsubstantiated and appears to be constructed through the misattribution of claims to his cited sources. On pages 33 and 38, he asserts that there's a paucity of data in his research area, without evidence or elaboration. On page 13, Mike makes two assertions to frame his study. First, that the research on technique and fitness characteristics variables is much less unified than research on psychological variables. And second, that there is very little information on the fitness characteristic differences between athletes of differing capability. For both claims, he cites two sources: Bomper and Half 2010, and a book chapter by his supervisor Mike Stone and Margaret Stone, Stone and Stone 2010. As soon as I saw that Mike used the exact same citations for each of these consecutive claims, alarm bells rang. It seemed unlikely that both statements could be supported by the same two references, and I had to double check. I'm glad I did, because an examination of these sources reveals that they don't support Mike's assertions. Starting with Bomper and Half 2010, Periodization, Theory, and Methodology of Training, as the title would suggest, it's a book about the long-term cyclical structure of training. It doesn't contain any statement or analysis comparing the relative unity of research across the psychological, technical, and fitness characteristics of athletes. Citing it here is irrelevant at best and misleading at worst. As to Stone and Stone, 2010, this citation refers to a chapter on resistance training modes, primarily focused on the practical differences between free weights and machines. Its scope is narrow, and the only research gap it identifies, on pages 352 through 353, relates to the specific transfer of free weights versus machine training to performance tasks. It makes no broad pronouncements about the state of the literature on fitness characteristics versus psychology. Mike has therefore attributed his thesis' foundational premise to sources that don't support it. And this isn't an isolated lapse. In fact, Mike repeatedly misrepresents the sources he cites. Let's take the very first passage of the thesis. Individual sport performance in any skill, and the differences in performance between individual athletes, is generated by a combination of three theoretical constructs: sport psychology, technique, and fitness characteristics. Bomper and Half, 2010. And then he's got that equation. Besides the grammatical error, is generated should be are generated, and the two awkwardly stacked colons, the citation is inaccurate. Bomper and Half never refer to these three elements as theoretical constructs. They describe them as factors, aspects, or abilities. Nor do they define skill as the sum of these components, nor present anything resembling Mike's pseudo-mathematical model, which, once again, is never justified later in the thesis. It's simply asserted and left unexamined. In fact, Bomper and Half present a much broader framework. On page 57 of their book, they state, "All athletic programs should address the physical, technical, tactical, psychological, and theoretical aspects of training." On page 5, they list these as part of a planning sequence: performance objective, physical preparation, technical preparation, tactical preparation, psychological preparation, and theoretical preparation. Mike includes psychology, technique, and fitness, but omits tactical and theoretical preparation entirely, despite Bomper and Half devoting whole sections to them. Mike's version reduces their multifaceted model to a simplistic triad, culminating in the unsubstantiated claim on page 33 that all variation in athletic performance can be explained by these three factors. Yet as Bomper and Half make clear, other contributors, such as strategy, environment, social dynamics, are also essential. The pattern of misrepresentation continues. On page 15, Mike writes that technique is a pure theoretical construct that is very difficult or impossible to isolate completely in the laboratory, again citing Bomper and Half. But they say no such thing. Their treatment of technique is concrete and practice-oriented. They focus on skill acquisition and its role in performance. This line appears to be Mike's own speculation, falsely attributed to Bomper and Half to lend it unearned authority. This is a bad look for what are literally the very first citations in the thesis. Mike not only fails to demonstrate a deep critical engagement with a complex body of knowledge, but consistently distorts other people's work and assigns his own ideas to established authorities. This pattern falls well short of the intellectual honesty and scholarly rigor expected of a PhD candidate. Mike's thesis fails to meet the threshold of care, rigor, originality, and cohesion. I've already substantiated the first three deficiencies: care, rigor, and originality, in previous sections. To recap, Mike's thesis distorts its cited works, manufactures a research gap from those distortions, corrupts its own data, copy-pastes entire sections without revision, contains hundreds of basic grammatical, typographical, and formatting errors, scarcely justifies its methods, fails to engage critically with relevant literature, draws strong conclusions from non-significant findings without adequate caveats, and contributes little, if anything, to the theoretical development of sports science. This final section concentrates on the remaining pillar, cohesion, which I haven't yet explored in depth. In Mike's thesis, the empirical chapters, 3, 4, and 5, are thematically linked, each exploring interrelationships among the same general set of fitness characteristics within the same cohort. The introduction, chapter 1, sets the stage, and the final chapter, chapter 6, attempts to summarize the findings. Superficially, this follows a recognizable thesis structure. But in practice, the document reads more like a loose bundle of standalone journal articles rather than a unified scholarly work. Each empirical chapter examines a different angle. Chapter 3 focuses on strength, Chapter 4 on vertical jump and sprint speed, Chapter 5 on body composition. And while all draw from the same dataset, the findings in one chapter aren't used to refine or build upon the next. There's no progressively deepening single investigation. A more cohesive thesis might have used Chapter 3's results to inform a more complex model tested in Chapter 4, and so on, or employed multivariate techniques from the outset to explore all relationships in an integrated fashion. The thesis's disjointed feel is worsened by the extensive repetition, particularly in the methodology sections. As already discussed, multi-page blocks are duplicated almost verbatim across chapters 3, 4, and 5. The paragraph justifying the extreme group comparisons, a questionable and pivotal methodological choice, appears word for word on pages 44 through 45, 69, and 92. This isn't reiteration for clarity. It's wholesale duplication. The same grammatical structure, phrasing, and order of sentences recur without any adaptation to the specific research questions of each chapter. This cut-and-paste approach matters. It suggests laziness. Instead of tailoring the methods to the distinctive aims of each chapter, Mike treats them as interchangeable boilerplate. Instead of revising and refining his explanations, really an essential part of thoughtful scholarship, he sidesteps the process altogether. The result is not a cohesive thesis, but a mechanical assemblage that lacks both intellectual momentum and internal coherence. In summary, Mike's thesis can't be said to be careful, rigorous, cohesive, or original. It fails to meet the basic standards of doctoral scholarship. There's a scene in The Theory of Everything, the Stephen Hawking biopic, where Stephen is being examined for his PhD. The examiners point out serious flaws in the first three chapters of his thesis, problems that would normally raise concerns. But then they get to chapter 4, and it's so bold, so elegant, and so breathtakingly original that the examiners basically drop their red pens and go, "Well, this changes everything." And just like that, Stephen earns his PhD. That can happen. If a thesis is groundbreaking enough, you can certainly overlook some mistakes. But that's precisely the problem here. Mike's thesis never delivers that moment. There's no chapter 4 revelation. There's no towering insight that redeems what came before. Instead, we're left with pages of weak argumentation, muddled prose, copy-pasted content, basic errors, incompetent data entry, false citations, and conclusions so banal they might as well be common knowledge, that stronger athletes are more powerful and leaner athletes jump higher. If you're going to ask an examiner to look past a mountain of technical and stylistic flaws, then the work needs to repay that generosity with substance. Mike's thesis doesn't. It wants the Stephen Hawking exception, but collapses the moment you ask whether it says anything new. When judged against the formal criteria, the verdict is inescapable. Mike's engagement with the literature is superficial and uncritical. This is to say nothing of how in several instances he misrepresents the literature he cites and uses those misrepresentations to manufacture a research gap. Mike fails to demonstrate a proper understanding of the principles, strengths, and limitations of his chosen methods. And most critically, Mike neither generates original knowledge nor makes a significant contribution to his field. At best, he just replicates already well-known findings. Mike fails to show independence of thought or approach. His work is derivative, and between the incompetent data entry, the rampant copy-pasting, the convoluted writing, and the hundreds of basic grammatical, typographical, and formatting mistakes, Mike's thesis can't be said to have communicated its findings effectively. And while I can't say that Mike's research contains glaring ethical oversights, besides the careless and consistent distortions of cited works, his dissertation ultimately fails to constitute a careful, rigorous, and cohesive piece of original research. Together, these are grounds for outright failure. My critique is driven by a number of motivations, all converging on a single point: the need for a higher standard of intellectual integrity in how we evaluate expertise, particularly in the fitness industry, where critical thinking is in short supply and credentials often go unquestioned. The problem is bigger than Mike. Mike's thesis didn't pass in a vacuum. It passed in an entire academic ecosystem that allowed it to. Fields with serious intellectual standards, like mathematics or classical studies, simply wouldn't let this level of work through. Yet in sports science, Mike's dissertation was deemed sufficient. This raises urgent questions. Is sports science a serious discipline, or just a diploma mill? Are the checks and balances of academia, supervision, peer review, intellectual critique, even functioning in this field? If Mike's dissertation is representative, then the answer is no. The appeal to authority is a logical fallacy that asserts that a claim is true simply because an authority figure believes it, without offering sound reasoning or solid evidence. It can also be used to dismiss criticism. Mike has a PhD, so he's right. You don't, so you're wrong. Arguments like these are intellectually lazy, and I reject them outright. If your takeaway from my critique is that Mike should be dismissed solely because he didn't attend an elite university for his postgraduate studies, then you've missed the point. This isn't an elitist argument about academic rankings. Excellent work can emerge from obscure institutions, and mediocre work can emerge from the world's top universities. My point is this: credentials aren't arguments. A PhD in itself doesn't entitle someone to automatic deference. Expertise must be demonstrated, not presumed. And when Mike produces a sloppy dissertation, makes absurd public claims,
"You are presuming you know more than me about the thing I'm one of the top experts in the world in, and also the thing I'm literally involved in myself. So whatever ideas you have about how I can improve, just f*** right off."
He isn't showing expertise. He's hiding behind the appearance of it. If you're determined to make appeals to authority, despite everything I've just said, then at the very least pick a better authority. Because with Mike, you can't even afford to scratch the surface. So when Mike slaps PhD approved on a product, as he did with this protein drink, just remember, it isn't a mark of trustworthiness. It's a warning label. I know I've just said that we should judge claims on their merits, not on who's making them. But in practice, that's not always how it works. Most people can't independently verify every scientific or technical assertion they encounter, and it's reasonable that they defer to experts instead. The problem is when the so-called expert isn't up to scratch. That's what makes sloppy work like Mike's a genuine issue. Mike invites trust by flashing his credentials, while quietly banking on the fact that nobody will check what's behind them. I get that a critique like mine may erode public trust in expertise. But maybe it should. If a flimsy PhD can boost the credibility of someone whose work doesn't hold up, then people are well within their rights to question those who wave around their credentials at every turn. None of this is to say that we should abandon trust in experts. It means we should be more selective about who gets to count as one. Credentials should mark the start of inquiry, not the end of it. If someone invokes his or her PhD to win arguments,
"You are presuming you know more than me,"
or sell products, the least we can do is ask, does the work live up to the title? If nothing else, I hope my critique highlights just how much the quality of research degrees can vary. A PhD ought to signal excellence, but in reality, the standard ranges from world-class to frankly embarrassing. By exposing the shaky foundations beneath some doctorates, my aim isn't to dismiss expertise. It's to prompt closer scrutiny of those who use the title doctor as a shield against criticism or a shameless marketing tool. Let's talk about what Mike's thesis reveals. A blueprint for how to look like an authority without being one. The playbook is simple. Enter a low-standard field at a low-ranked university. Produce work that wouldn't pass at a high-ranking institution. Then brand yourself as Doctor and leverage your title at every opportunity for professional gain. Because whether your doctorate is from MIT in quantum mechanics or East Tennessee State University in sport physiology, the title Doctor is conferred all the same.
Dr. Mike, geez, that's a big deal. And I've noticed that carries a lot of weight. So for me, only by signaling, if only by signaling, my PhD was a really good idea. What about Dr. Samsulik? Like, oh, so that f***s. So then the doctor is like, there's like a big deal there that does something.
But this playbook has a fatal flaw. In the digital age, a dissertation is a public, permanent, and searchable record. So if you write one as sloppy as Mike's, then you'll spend your whole career hoping it's never exposed for what it is. For peace of mind, it's better to write work you can be genuinely proud of. Work that's able to withstand scrutiny. Because who knows? One day, it may have to. Mike describes himself as an exercise scientist. If he's the exercise scientist he claims to be, then how come he isn't cautious and circumspect like all the other scientists I've met? How is it that a purported exercise scientist with a PhD in the field can make such unscientific, irresponsible, and absurd claims as these?
"You should probably train more than the pro bodybuilders you follow. An hour of extra sleep that brings you from sleeping 2 hours less than you need to one less than you need is unreal powerful and comparable to tons of anabolic drugs."
People see striated glutes and they go, "That can't be healthy." And I would love to be in real life with that person instead of over social media and say, "Okay, no, I hear you. Why not?"
"If you're getting stronger week to week, you're under training."
"If we go now and play football, soccer, and we run for like 10 minutes, I will be insanely sore the next day. My lower body, my adductors, quads, hamstrings."
"They're growing."
"Are they?"
"A ton."
Well, finally, we can explain the disconnect. The chasm between Mike's title and his behavior prompts the very question this critique has answered. What is Mike's PhD? What authority does it truly confer? The answer is that it confers authority only so long as no one actually reads it. Last, this analysis belongs to a larger project of understanding Mike Israetel's delusions of grandeur. Mike Israetel speaks as if he's a towering intellect in the fitness space.
"I'm both on a raw IQ scale smarter than almost every coach, maybe every coach. And I know more about physiology, body responses, etc. than they do."
"You've never met anyone with as much willpower as me. And whatever it is you think you're good at in your life, I'd probably take about a year and become an authority in the field in which you think you're good."
"And also in every category of human behavior, I'm tougher than you. I can train closer to failure than you. I can do it for longer. I have more willpower than you. I'm funnier than you. I'm smarter than you. And I'm better at being a than you."
"So if you talk to me about anything with resistance training and hypertrophy,
Yes, I consider myself to be one of the world's preeminent experts on all of that, especially in its application and interaction with science. I make no excuses for that. I will debate anyone in the world about that. That's easy.
I haven't met a whole lot of people in the bodybuilding industry with whose raw intellect I was blown away.
You are presuming you know more than me about the thing I'm one of the top experts in the world in, and also the thing I'm literally involved in myself. So whatever ideas you have about how I can improve, just f*** right off.
Because I've taken enough IQ tests, and you can only write so many books and be on so many podcasts until people are like, you're pretty smart. I've taken the Raven's Advanced Progressive Matrices test, and I pegged at scale high. So you get every single question right. And so my IQ is above 160. We don't know how high because they don't do standardized IQ tests above that. You do that enough times, you enough PhD programs, enough book, enough teaching awards, enough authorships, enough all the stuff, enough millions and app designs and all the stuff, and dealing with otherwise really smart people, and they walk away being like, that guy's real smart.
And bigger and stronger than Mike Mentzer. That's it. Yeah. So all of a sudden, that changes the game. Yeah. I'm more educated than Mike Mentzer. I know more things than Mike Mentzer.
I have very elite genetics, not swagger. It's just stating a fact.
There's a very high probability that I'm much better at making fun of people than you are. As a matter of fact, I can sit face to face with you and slam dunk on your entire life. It'd just be real bad news. Things I wouldn't even feel comfortable saying that are just true about you.
Because the amount of just backslapping intellectual just overkill I can push onto them, they just have no idea how far afield they are of their abilities.
I'll just settle for being a, you know, jujitsu killer, famous millionaire.
Am I a perfectionist asshole with a PhD? Yeah, hell yeah, that's why I say like that.
People are like, you know, it's like, what do girls like in a guy? And a ton of girls, as well as a ton of older people, would say intelligence. That's the biggest lie I've ever been told in my life.
What?
Nobody out here likes intelligence? What, are you kidding me? Yeah. Like, if girls liked intelligence, I'd be swimming in that from day one. I've never met a single girl who I was convinced was actually attracted to intelligence.
The irony is that the very thing which, in Mike's own mind, confirms his superiority, his PhD, actually reveals the opposite when examined closely. Mike hasn't demonstrated mastery, even in his own domain, let alone anyone else's. The purpose of this critique was to place Mike Israetel's PhD thesis under the microscope of the academic scrutiny it should have faced in 2013. My conclusion is undeniable. Mike Israetel's PhD thesis is a failure. It's a work built on a non-existent research gap, lazily pursued with a poorly justified methodology, and culminating in findings that aren't just unremarkable, but are, by Mike's own admission, unoriginal. These core intellectual failings are amplified by a staggering lack of scholarly diligence. Mike's PhD thesis is a morass of conceptual confusion, stylistic pretension, distortions of cited works, and basic errors. It's less a work of scholarship and more an exercise in academic masquerade. A PhD thesis is supposed to signify the creation of new knowledge. It's a testament to an individual's ability to think critically, originally, and rigorously. Mike Israetel's PhD thesis doesn't celebrate these values. It betrays them. It's a work that leverages the language of science to say nothing new, and its successful submission represents a systemic failure of academic quality control. Ultimately, Mike's PhD thesis is the key to understanding the disconnect between the persona and the reality. Mike Israetel presents himself as a formidable intellect, a top expert whose authority is secured by the highest academic qualification. And yet, the primary evidence for that authority, the dissertation itself crumbles under the slightest pressure, revealing not the masterful work of a scholar, but the careless and derivative output of a candidate who didn't put in the necessary effort. This isn't an appeal to a higher standard. It's an appeal to the minimum standard. The fitness community, and anyone who values intellectual honesty, deserve better than this.
Hey, Solomon Nelson, we're training at 3 o'clock today, and you said, oh my gosh, like, we're